Okay, just before I begin, just apologies in advance to any Mandarin speakers for some of my pronunciation. Okay, well, from the perspective of the capitalist class, war between the West and China is inevitable. We are in the early stages of a Cold War between two reactionary imperialist states. The tensions between the hegemonic superpower and a rising imperialist rival will shape global politics in our lifetime. With Trump's trade war, this tension is already beginning to reshape the global imperialist order. For the left in Australia, a country whose ruling class has been one of the most reliable allies of the US and an Asia-Pacific imperialist power in its own right, standing against militarism, anti-Chinese racism, and any future conflict will be a vital responsibility. Opposing conflict with China, and when necessary, building an anti-war movement which rejects militarism and racism could become, I'm not saying immediately, but could become the defining fight of our lifetimes. Our starting point is to recognise that the class divide abroad and at home means that the international working class have a common interest that crosses borders and imperialist alliances. The Australian, Chinese and US working class have no material interest in conflict or in war or any kind of great power standoff. We have every reason to stand with the 2 million protesters fighting in Hong Kong for democracy, every reason to stand with striking Chinese workers fighting against ruthless exploitation in the horrific factories of Shenzhen. Our rulers, on the other hand, are locked into an intractable competition, one that at the moment involves economic sanctions, tariffs and espionage, but whose logic leads to an arms race, militarism, conflict and potentially nuclear war. There is no length the US ruling class won't go to in order to safeguard its position as global hegemon. And there's no length that China's ruling class won't go to in order to expand its trade routes, markets and influence. And already this has seen a massive ramping up of repression, most notably in Hong Kong and Xinjiang, where the Uyghur oppressed minority live. So the slogan of the International Socialist Tendency, which Socialist Alternative came out of, which was once neither Washington nor Moscow, but neither Washington nor Beijing, is once again, I think, relevant again. So in Australia, the ruling class has long acknowledged the tension between having the US as an unshakable military ally and China as Australian capitalism's biggest trading partner. But in the last 12 months, speculation about how to deal with this tension has left the kind of obscure back pages of the Sydney Morning Herald and is now front page news or regularly high profile news. Anti-China rhetoric is now a daily feature of Australian media and political discourse. Every day, the Australian media is churning out more and more articles decrying Chinese influence in Australian politics and institutions. From hysteria over a Chinese company buying the Darwin port to racist attacks on Chinese international students operating supposedly as a fifth column in Australian universities and in student unions. Earlier this month, people might have seen Liberal Party backbencher Andrew Hastie raise the temperature with an opinion piece in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age arguing that Australia needed to wake up to the threat of China and comparing the Australian ruling class's apparent complacency with the French ruling class before facing the rise of Nazi Germany. So we can expect, I think, more of this jingoistic and nationalist language to ramp up as the tensions between the US and China escalate over trade, over movement in the South China Seas and other geographical points of tension. So the global order, the global imperialist order is going through a kind of moment of transformation. So for all of my life, it's been undisputed that the United States of America has been the only superpower in the world. Its reach is global, both militarily and economically. While other imperialist powers have regional influence, not since the breaking apart of the USSR has there been a global rival to American hegemony. All of this is beginning to change. While the United States remains the world's only superpower, its global influence is increasingly challenged by the ascendancy of China and is now also challenged by a host of regional imperialist players, including Iran and Russia. For myself, and I think probably for most people in this room, Even though we've lived in a world with endless wars, particularly, you know, in the Middle East, for most people, war has not affected our lives greatly. I think today we are now moving into a different stage of competition, the return of great power rivalry. So in December last year, at an airport in Canada, Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer for the Chinese tech company Huawei, was detained, interrogated and arrested at the request of the US government. The US government alleges that Meng violated US sanctions against Iran. Meng now awaits the outcome of an appeal facing extradition to the US, where she faces 13 charges of conspiracy, fraud and obstruction. In the second quarter of this year, Huawei outstripped Apple in the sale of smartphones. As tensions rise between the US and China, the telecommunications and electronics company has been at the centre of commercial and political intrigue. It was banned from rolling out Australia and New Zealand's 5G network, and the FBI and CIA have warned American citizens against buying Huawei or ZTE phones. So Trump's trade war with China has led the US to also effectively ban US companies from selling parts to Huawei. And after Trump actually signalled in negotiations with China that his administration might actually relax this blacklisting, Congress rushed to introduce a new bill which would empower Congress to have the final say over export controls on this company. So you can see it's not just a Trumpism. The controversies over Huawei are a microcosm of America's anxieties and increasingly aggressive posturing towards China. So the United States is facing the prospect of being economically outstripped by China, just as US tech companies are increasingly challenged by China's growing high-tech industries. The US is increasingly willing to use tariffs to clamp down on China's economic expansion, rather than the more recent strategy of integrating China into US-dominated international institutions. And America is increasingly leaning on its allies, like Australia and Canada, to do more to curb the threat China poses to its hegemony. And it's increasingly clear that the more confrontational strategy is not just an idiosyncrasy of Donald Trump, but is a hardening of the entire US political establishment. So most of all, what the arrest of a high-powered figure of the Chinese capitalist class tells us is that we are well and truly entering a new Cold War. Western governments are increasingly sounding the alarm bells about China's spying potential, soft power tactics in the developing world, as well as paranoia about fifth column political influence by Chinese citizens or people of Chinese backgrounds living in the West. Well, I want to talk briefly about China's growth. So hopefully it won't be news to anybody in this room that Socialist Alternative does not see China as being socialist or communist in any way. With the fastest growing number of billionaires in the world and one of the most intensively exploited working classes, China is decidedly capitalist. A state capitalist regime which is increasingly globalised with rapidly growing military capabilities. And China uses the language of socialism to cover its crimes, much like Western leaders use the language of democracy to cover theirs. So America is still the unrivaled global superpower. But while the US military continues to dwarf its closest rivals, on other measures, China is beginning to catch up. The stupendous growth of China's economy in the last three decades means that the US is now close to being knocked out of the position of the world's largest economy for the first time since 1871. The United States is certainly not close to being outstripped in terms of its military, though. The US has approximately 800 formal military bases in 80 countries. By contrast, only 11 other countries have any foreign military bases, some 70 in altogether. The US also spends as much on its military as the next seven biggest militaries combined. But there are also some disadvantages that come from being the global hegemon. The US has had to pay to be the global cop on the beat, while China can focus its investments on the areas it most has to catch up on, has been doing this, building a navy, high-tech weaponry, and a missile defence system. But aside from China's economic growth, one of the key factors behind the growing tensions is the relative decline of the US empire. After decades of unrivaled dominance, the massive gap between the US and its nearest rivals is slowly beginning to shorten. The bursting of the global financial crisis, which shook Wall Street in 2008, coincided with US failure in the Middle East. The Iraq invasion, the project which was supposed to launch a new American century and guarantee US hegemony across the oil-rich region, instead bogged the US down in the military down in an endless and costly war in which regional rivals, particularly Iran, have gained ground at American military's expense. While the US has struggled to disentangle itself from the Middle East, China has taken advantage to be more assertive in its region. So imperialism is a system of intercapitalist competition and rivalry. And capitalism doesn't grow uniformly. Some states and regions leap ahead, others lag behind. This unevenness defines the hierarchy of power in the world. The uneven development of capitalism redistributes power among the leading states. This means that the balance of power is constantly shifting, creating the conditions for new conflicts. Today, after a long period of relative stability in the imperialist hierarchy, with a single unchallenged superpower, the law of unevenness is once again reasserting itself with the rise of China. What was sometimes called by Marxists the unipolar moment, with the US as the untrammeled global hegemon, is now over. So how has the American ruling class allowed this to happen so far? So the US ruling class thought it could ensure its hegemony by incorporating the world under its economic auspices. China was going to be incorporated into the American economic system through globalization. And for a while, this appeared to work. China entered the World Trade Organization in 2001, produced cheap goods for Walmart, was a sweatshop which drove the growth of Apple, and today General Motors actually produces more cars to sell to the Chinese market than to the American one. But as China became the workshop of the world, the US deindustrialized. The logic of US corporations searching for the cheapest supply of labour power started to undermine one of the pillars of US dominance, its manufacturing. This could only have happened in a period of relative peace with one superpower. But since the Obama administration, the US establishment has attempted to head off its relative decline by reorienting militarily and politically towards confronting China. Obama's encirclement strategy, the 2011 pivot to Asia, involves sending 60% of the US Navy to the region to police growing tensions like those in the South China Seas and to operate freedom of navigation exercises around China's artificially built islands. Obama's signature policy was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, and the TPP would have been the largest free trade deal in history, lowering tariffs and other non-tariff barriers to trade between 11 Pacific countries and the US, importantly locking China out in an effort to further integrate Pacific countries within the US economy. Obama's Defence Secretary Ashton Carter at the time declared, "Passing TPP is important to me as another aircraft carrier." But just a few years later, Trump tore up the TPP. And Trump has been ratcheting up tensions with rivals and allies alike by either threatening or actually implementing tariffs. While this has been touted as a radical departure from US foreign policy, with liberal commentators sometimes criticising Trump for being isolationist and threatening to tear apart the rules-based international order, in reality, Trump's tariffs represent a different approach to the overriding imperialist question that the entire US ruling class is asking: how to confront the rise of China. And this is not the policy of one loony man. It's the policy of the Pentagon, the NSA, the CIA, etc. The United States' hardline approach to China is often associated with the particularities of the Trump administration. And obviously there is some truth to this. Like, Trump has stacked out his administration with anti-China hawks like Navarro. But in reality, the broad thrust of what Trump has been doing is supported by the entire spectrum of the US ruling class, including the Democrats. If anything, the liberal political establishment has criticised Trump for not doing enough to confront China. Chuck Schumer has swung between heaping praise on the president's confrontational approach to China and criticising him from the right. Trump's trade war is more of a difference. Is more a difference of style than of content, with some arguments amongst the ruling class over tactics. So before Trump's aluminium tariffs in March last year, the Democrats had been pushing the president to get tough on China. Where they differ is largely a question of tactics and style opposing tariffs on US allies. So the other motivation which underpins Trump's trade war is reorganising production to bring important industry back to the United States. And this has nothing to do with helping the American working class with manufacturing jobs. Attempting to reshore manufacturing is about ensuring US homegrown industries' ability to arm the country. Disentangling some of the production networks that arm the military from the integration with China's production chains is important for the US ruling class. And I think there's no guarantee that tariffs and a trade war can achieve this reorganisation, but if that fails, there's always the 5% increase in defence spending. Okay, I want to talk a bit about China's increasing assertiveness as an imperialist power in its own right. So China has a $275 billion trade surplus with the US. And aside from stimulating an overheated economy, the key thing that China is doing with that surplus is modernising its military. They're building a navy to project power in the South China Seas. 30% of world commerce goes through the South China Seas. At the moment, the US pretty much control it. So it's inevitable that China would eventually try to push the US out. And it's equally true that it's inevitable the US would try to resist this. So the other signature imperialist strategy of Xi Jinping is the Belt and Road Initiative, which is sometimes called the New Silk Road. This is the most ambitious international infrastructure project since the Marshall Plan at the end of World War II. So Belt and Road is attempting to establish one giant tricontinental market held together under Chinese dominance, integrating trade routes across Africa, Asia and Europe. Again, like Trump's kind of strategy with the tariffs, there's no guarantee that this is that they can pull this off, but that's the kind of ambition that underpins the Belt and Road. So China's assertiveness abroad has been matched by a ruthless crackdown on dissent at home. Currently, the Chinese ruling class has been amassing military vehicles at the border of Hong Kong. It's established one of the most extreme surveillance states in human history to repress the Uyghur population. And Chinese worker activists and socialists are persecuted by police and driven underground. Okay, I just wanted to talk now a little bit more about the Marxist kind of approach, theoretical approach to imperialism, because I think that this is essential in understanding the tensions between America and China. So Marxists argue that inter-imperialist rivalry and war is an inevitable outcome of capitalism, a system built on ruthless competition. Competition between capitalists leads to ever greater concentration of capitalist firms until they become massive and monopolistic and increasingly integrated into their nation state. This competition spills beyond national borders and becomes competition on an international scale. And that competition ceases to just be purely economic, based on trade and prices, and instead becomes a never-ending struggle between whole blocks of capital and the nation states that they are in for regional or even global dominance. And this is the process that Marxists, going back to Lenin and Bukharin, talked about on the eve of World War I. So while the balance of forces between different states, different blocks of capital, will inevitably change over time, the underlying dynamic doesn't change. Any peace that exists within the system is only a temporary standoff in this constant state of competition. The peaceful transnational integration of capitals is impossible. I say that because this is very different to what liberalism tells us about trade and diplomacy. Liberalism, particularly in the era of neoliberalism, told us that globalisation, the expansion of international trade and integration of international production chains would mean that wars between major powers like that in the First and Second World War can never happen again. These theories, which many on the left, I think, accepted, told us that businesses would not accept costly inter-imperialist wars that could unravel production chains, destroy investments and dampen profits in the era of globalisation. But capitalism isn't just dominated by the short-term profits of individual businesses. Our society is shaped by the competition between increasingly concentrated blocks of capital. Conflict between China and the US also would not be the first time that great powers with high levels of trade and economic integration went to war with each other. On the eve of World War I, there was significant trade between the UK and Germany, for example, and Australia sold huge quantities of steel to Japan just a very short time before declaring war on them in World War II. But while the scale of economic integration of the rival economies is much greater than it was in the First and Second World War, the underlying dynamic of competition means that I think despite complex webs of interconnected supply chains, war between the US and China is not only possible, it is something that both sides are actively planning for. And that's what informs the method behind Trump's seeming madness. The US needs to once again be the arsenal of democracy, to rearm itself to defend its hegemony through violence. To do this, it cannot continue to allow China to be the workshop of the world. At the very least, not the workshop for American high-tech military manufacturing. You cannot go to war without industry, and Trump's Make America Great Again mantra is not just a racist and populist sop to his Republican base. It's a total domestic and foreign policy program aimed at bringing military supply chains back home to better project war, US war capacity abroad. So what's Australian capitalism's place in all of this? To start with, I just want to clear up a couple of common liberal myths about Australia and war, which I think are surprisingly common even on the progressive left. So firstly, Australia is not just bullied to follow the whims of the US. The full spectrum of the Australian ruling class support the US alliance, not because they're under the thumb of the American ruling class, but because it's good for Australian capitalism. And secondly, Australia isn't a little island nation that just fell in with a bad crowd. Australia is an imperialist power in its own right. Australia is a middling imperialist power. We're the 14th largest economy in the world, fourth most powerful military in Asia, with a long colonial and imperialist history, occupying, bullying, occasionally backing coups, and dominating our closest neighbours. Making an undying alliance with a great power ally has been the cornerstone of Australian foreign policy since independence, first with Britain and since the end of the World War II with the US. And this relationship is mutually beneficial for the capitalists of Australia and our great power ally. It's for this reason that any hint of US decline in the Asia Pacific is seen by Australian capitalism as a threat to Australia's influence in the region. And this is what's openly now being talked about widely in most Australian media publications. So there is a major tension for Australian capitalism between China, the basis of Australia's economic growth, and the US, our great power partner in a military strategy that has lasted for 8 decades. Ultimately, when that tension is tested, the US alliance trumps all other considerations. So Liberal backbencher Andrew Hastie, his hawkish column last month in the Sydney Morning Herald, gives a picture of the kind of Cold War rhetoric we can expect in the coming years. And he said, "If we don't understand the challenge ahead for our civil society, in our parliaments, in our universities, in our private enterprises, in our charities, our little platoons, then choices will be made for us." Peter Dutton immediately backed up Hastie's comments, saying that foreign interference is at an all-time high in Australia. And it's not just the hard right of the Liberal Party. There's no doubt that the entire spectrum of the Australian political class is staunchly pro the US alliance. So Australia has been pushing for the US to have an increased role in the region for a long time and kind of bemoans that the pivot to Asia wasn't really that successful under Obama. When Obama launched that pivot to Asia, he did it amidst a whirlwind tour of the region when PM Julia Gillard posed with Obama to welcome 2,500 US Marines to project power and deter threats to peace in our region. So while the Australian ruling class are on a unity ticket on the question of the US alliance, there are debates amongst the ruling class about how to navigate the China question. The tensions Australia experiences from having its key economic partner, increasingly a military rival, crop up in debates about how far to push diplomatic disagreements, how paranoid to be about Chinese investment, how to compete for influence in the Asia Pacific, and what military war games and freedom of navigation exercises Australia should participate in. I think those kind of debates are more and more going to crop up in Australian discourse. So Australia is obviously not about to cut economic ties with China in the medium term. This would be disastrous for Australia's economy. While commentators occasionally prosecute an argument that Australian industry should diversify away from reliance on selling to China, there are no significant steps being taken in that direction, and it's pretty hard to imagine how that could even happen. But in the last couple of years and months, Australian journalists, politicians and academics have been ratcheting up the nationalist and racist hysteria about Chinese influence in politics, Chinese investment in Australia and the potential for Chinese spying. For strategically important infrastructure, the state has stepped in to block Chinese businesses. There's also a growing outcry by Australian politicians and liberal commentators about China's influence in our backyard, i.e. other countries. There was a spate of sensationalist articles last year after China funded the development of a port in Vanuatu. China is also increasingly financing aid and loans to South Pacific countries, and that obviously is for imperialist reasons. For the Australian ruling class, this spending spree is a threat to their influence in the region, which until recently had been secured through a trickle of aid and the threat of force. Australia's military response to the growing influence of China has been to ramp up its side of the arms race in the Asia Pacific. And the recent passage of the very draconian espionage bill, while generally playing the role of eroding civil liberties in Australia, was overwhelmingly about China, about increasing Australian spying and security capabilities vis-a-vis China. So Australia is the first of the Five Eyes, Orwellianly named Five Eyes countries, to pass such a bill, with New Zealand, the UK, the US and Canada hoping to follow suit as part of their joint spying program. So alongside the rearmament of the Australian military, the Australian political establishment is trying to reorient Australia ideologically. Again, politicians are harking back to yellow peril language to accuse Chinese people of stealing our jobs, driving up property prices and taking all the baby formula. Seriously. This racism serves the function of undermining social solidarity, providing a populist scapegoat for the rising costs of living, but most importantly, creating a nationalist climate of hostility to China that could be mobilised in the future to support any conflict. So onto what I think the left should say about China. So as the tensions ramp up between the US and China, the international left will be faced with a challenge we haven't seen since the end of the Cold War. On one level, it's easy enough to provide strident political opposition to wars when they are so clearly the intervention and occupation of a big imperialist power against an oppressed or smaller country. It might not be easy to build a movement that wins, but as the million-strong demonstration against the war in Iraq show, there's plenty of space to make an argument against war when it is so obviously one-sided. Today, the left must prepare to stand against rising nationalism, racism and militarism in a conflict between two imperialist powers, where every aspect of the political establishment will be mobilised to support our nation state. To do this, we must also stand in unequivocal solidarity with the struggles of the oppressed within China against their authoritarian state, such as the inspiring movement in Hong Kong, the illegal strikes by workers across mainland China, and in support of oppressed minorities like the Uyghurs. This international solidarity of the working class is the only force which is capable of stopping imperialist tensions and potential conflict. So I think that no one outside of the anti-capitalist left is taking this question seriously today. And many on the liberal and reformist left are already taking the wrong line on China. Greens progressives, many of them, who would have marched against Iraq, are now joining the chorus of China bashing. Like former Greens candidate Clive Hamilton, whose book Silent Invasion accused Chinese business people, international students and Australian citizens of Chinese descent of potentially forming a fifth column threat to Australia. So in the coming decade, we will need a left ready to stand against nationalism, militarism and racism. We need a left that can call out the hypocrisy of the Australian and American ruling class, who have occasionally feign concern for Hong Kong while preparing for war in the future. And actually, at the moment, Trump doesn't even pretend to feign concern for Hong Kong. He just says it's China's business. So we need a left that rejects either side of the imperialist conflict, showing solidarity to the movements by workers and the oppressed in China, while recognising that our main enemy is at home, our own ruling class. Okay, that was really excellent, interesting discussion. Really important questions raised, I think. I want to talk about a few of them. So starting on the one that David raised earlier about, like, debates in the Australian ruling class, because I think I briefly mentioned this, but there's a lot to go through. Like, there are debates in the Australian ruling class, obviously, over how to confront that seeming contradiction about the military alliance and the economic ties. But I think there is speculation definitely about, like, is America up to the kind of challenge or whatever. But I think it's important to say, like, there's no section of the Australian ruling class that wants to change its allegiance to China, which sometimes people talk about. Some of them, I think, want to make money for longer off China and think that the more hawkish rhetorically ones, like, look, we're all on board with the American alliance, just shut up for a while because there's heaps more iron ore to sell. So let's just, let's not, let, like, can't we just butter our bread at the same time as preparing for that without disrupting it too much. Like, when she was foreign minister, Julie Bishop was like more like able to talk about things like that. I remember an ABC kind of anti-China hysteria thing that she was interviewed, and she was like, oh, well, like the Netherlands has more foreign direct investment to Australia. She was kind of dismissed some of that stuff a bit. That was a while ago now, though. So I think there's like a section of people who are like, can't we do both? The ones that I think are the most concerned about is America up to the challenge have more of the concert of Asia thing that Hugh White talks about, which is like, he talks about in a more like liberal, couldn't we stop it from happening kind of way. But increasingly sections of the Australian military kind of speculators are saying, let's integrate ourselves more, like not just with America, but with Japan and some of the other kind of Western countries and stuff too, and kind of create, more joint military, war game practices and stuff with like a more diverse array of countries that are in the Western imperialist bloc, so that it's not just all hinged on America. On the thing that I think Jeff said about like the how do we confront the very serious the argument about like humanitarian intervention, given that China is such a like voracious human rights abuser, and I would say like you can point out the West hypocrisy and that is important, but like there's not anything pretty comparable to like some of the stuff that like China's doing, like the concentration camps that the Uyghurs are in, like they're more extensive than anything we've seen basically since like World War II. So I think like, and that's why I think I kind of disagree a bit with the thing that Jack said, that like actually can neither Washington and Canberra nor Beijing is like not as relevant as the main enemy is at home anymore because of the kind of humanitarian arguments. And like we can't we actually have to talk honestly about what China as an imperialist and oppressive authoritarian regime does, but say the West doesn't give a fuck about that. They have no interest in actually liberating the Uyghurs in the same way they had no interest in liberating the women of Afghanistan or anything like that, and that we think that a global struggle and solidarity between working class people have a shared interest in opposing militarism and opposing authoritarian governments and the increasing authoritarian actions of our own government. I'm not saying that that's like totally simple or whatever, but it's not totally a new thing that I think the left has had to confront. Like Margaret Thatcher pretended that she supported Solidarnosc when that happened in like the kind of communist bloc or whatever. So the kind of cynical way that the West sometimes says that it supports very supportable movements for liberation in countries that are they're in an opposed bloc with is kind of not totally new. What is new for like us since the end of the Cold War, though, is I really agree with the point that Josh made, that like Saddam Hussein was never a threat to Australia, the Australian state or whatever. And everyone could see that, a big mobilising thing in that era was that they lied about weapons of mass destruction and that it was so obviously actually about an imperialist push to dominate the oil rich region or whatever. Like China's involvement in like the Pacific countries and stuff is about in expanding its imperialist influence in the Asia Pacific. So it's not all just like racist hysteria. The point is it's hypocritical because Australia does the same thing, America does the same thing. We don't pick either side of these things, but we're focused on attacking our own ruling class because we're here, we're not in China. One last thing I just wanted to say on the thing about like there's sections of the capitalist class that kind of want to butter their bread while they prepare for things and like can be on the kind of softer section that don't want as much vicious rhetoric in case the Chinese Communist Party cuts off some like iron ore orders and stuff like that. Like BHP sold steel to Japan until like a very, very short amount of time before they declared war on Japan. And they justified this by saying, oh, we'll use the profits from selling steel to Japan to like rearm Australia. So like I just think that there's always going to be like minority sections of the Australian capitalist class who for their own particular interests or whatever like have a stake or whatever, a bit of a stake or whatever in like maintaining kind of economic relationships or whatever and are a bit of an outlier on the kind of jingoistic imperialist language or whatever. But at the end of the day, I think the entire direction that things are pushing in is a confrontation. And I agree more with Mick that I think that America has got 800 military bases around the world. I think that it's not going to just let them lie unused and cede its hegemony.